The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 10th day of January. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the former point guard of so many great Boston Celtic teams. 2015 Hall of Famer JoJo White will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to 2016 J.G. Taylor Spink Award winner from the Boston Globe, Dan Shaughnessy. So we got a little Boston flavor tonight on the show. Sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before I begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you will find sports information, show information, and so much more. So stop by and give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.SportsTalk1240.com. Well, my first guest played 12 years in the NBA and was a 7-time All-Star and 2-time NBA champion with the Boston Celtics. He also won the gold medal for the United States at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. He was elected to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts in 2015. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, JoJo White. JoJo, good evening.
Hey, good evening to you too.
It's great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, JoJo, you grew up in the St. Louis area. Safe to assume, I would guess, that you rooted for the Hawks. Who did you root for when you were growing up? Any favorite teams, favorite players?
Well, going through learning about the game itself. So I was like in it every day. I mean, you know, my parents sometimes just want to know where I am.
Yeah.
You know, so we played every chance we got, you know, when I was a youngster coming through.
Yeah, I understand, sure. Now, you played also with the Jayhawks at the University of Kansas. Now,
yes.
The players had to have a vote to see if you'd be welcome on the team. Explain that a little bit for us.
You mean to get to St. Louis?
Yes. No, for on the Kansas Jayhawks.
Okay. No, your question was?
The players had to have a vote to see if you'd be welcome to play on the basketball team.
Well, You any team that you're asking another soul, you know, that you don't know, just might have heard of you want to gather all the information you can,
right,
to include them, you know, to what they have worked hard to get to.
Understood.
The level that you're on, you know, anybody you want to bring in after that, you want to hope that they have as much knowledge that they bring, you know, as the knowledge that you already have there.
Certainly. That's very well put, JoJo. Now, in 1966, let's talk about the NCAA tournament against Texas Western. People may know that Texas Western is the University of Texas at El Paso today. This particular game was depicted in the 2006 film by Disney entitled Glory Road. Now, the big thing...
There.
Yeah, yeah. The big thing about Texas Western was that they had 5 black starters. But
yes.
Kansas had black starters as well.
Yes.
Now you hit that 30-foot jumper, JoJo, at the end of regulation. They say you stepped out of bounds. Take us through that play, will you?
Well, you know, you have to accept what they give you out there, especially, you know, when you're playing that close-up games that can be determined with a game that has, you know, a lot of the techniques on it, and, you know, they have more than the amount of whoever's calling the game,
mm-hmm,
to make sure that they're on top of it. You know, as officials, you have extra people in case you need extra, you know, in time to stand on top of the players that, you know, you're calling the different, you know, pawns against. So you get to be put in a lot of different situations, you know, as you develop, you know, the system when I was coming up.
Right. Now, what about that play? Did you say you didn't step out? You said your foot didn't hit that line, correct?
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, but everybody who watched it, you know, have their own opinion as to whether or not I'm saying the same thing as well. But I didn't. I'm not going to stand up with a bat and a broom and say I did.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
You know, put that extra energy in, and I know that I didn't do a thing, and then you just have to make up for it on the other end.
As folks may know, in that movie, the way Disney depicted it was that JoJo did step out of bounds. They had him very obviously stepping out of bounds. Where I don't think it was that obvious. But the rest, they say, is history. Texas Western went on to win that ball game against the Kansas Jayhawks, and as we say, let it be written, let it be done. So that's done and over with. But what an exciting ball game, huh, JoJo?
Oh, it was. It surely was. I mean, it's been talked about for a long time, and I was on that end. But we had an outstanding team with players who were on there that appreciated one another, and we really reached some high levels, you know, in the development, you know, of those talents.
Definitely. That was a great Kansas Jayhawks ball club. We'll move
forward
a little bit now, JoJo, to 1968, to the Olympics in Mexico City. Now, the U.S. team was not expected to win the gold medal because what happened was players either declined to participate, guys like Lou Alcindor or Elvin Hayes, or some guys weren't even chosen to play, like Pistol Pete, Calvin Murphy, Dan Issel. But that team persevered due to guys like you, Spencer Haywood, who was from a junior college, and went on to win the gold medal.
Well, it was all kinds of decisions and developments, you know, during that era. You know, it was the changes of young athletes as well as the ones who were helping to develop the athletes, all those type people. And so a lot of things got caught in between the, you know, the post as we developed on through. So the best you can do is the best that you can do as an individual player.
Right, and you guys did do the best. The men's team, led by JoJo White and Spencer Haywood, defeated Yugoslavia in the title game. They of course knocked out the Russians, who were heavily favored, weren't they, JoJo?
Oh, it was some fine, outstanding talent, you know, that you had to deal with as you developed, learning how to play and seeing the talents that you had to play against.
Definitely,
so, you know, it put the pressure on you to continue to develop, regardless of what you might think as an individual, because every time you come out on the floor, you had some talent that you had to play against, and you find out just how good you may be or how good may your team be.
That's for sure. We had Spencer Haywood on the show some time ago, and he always speaks very highly of that 1968 Olympic team.
Oh, he was awesome. I just saw him not too long ago, a week or so. It just made me feel good and filled me, because we spent some uptight and a lot of things that we talked over and over and over, teams that we spent, you know, time against and look forward to playing with him. If I have to sit and watch him, you know, it was appreciated, because I loved him so.
Good man. As folks may or may not know, Spencer went into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame with JoJo last summer of 2015. So they're both enshrined in Springfield.
Yes, sir.
Now, after the Olympics, JoJo, you were drafted in the first round by the Boston Celtics, who at that time had just won their 11th championship in 13 years with guys like Bill Russell. But there was some reluctance during the time of the draft because you had a military commitment.
Well, I didn't know. I didn't know either. I was wondering myself, was I going to, go into the draft, or do I have to play another round in college? You know, all I want to do is play.
Right.
And when I got the opportunity, once everything was settled, the decision that was made to go to the University of Kansas was the best one I could have.
For sure. Now, the great Red Auerbach was able to shorten your commitment to allow your participation in that first 69-70 NBA season. Talk a little bit for us, JoJo, about the great Red Auerbach at the helm of those great Boston Celtic clubs.
Oh, he was one of the best at what he did. He knew how to develop talent. He knew exactly the things to say to you. He knew when to get off of you. He knew when to put his arm around you. He knew all of what he needed to know from a coach standpoint to pass it on to his players. And I loved him so. And not just because he was outstanding as a basketball coach. He was just an outstanding gentleman as a person. And all of it included, I really honored him.
The great Red Auerbach, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
oh, yeah.
You had to endure a rebuilding season, JoJo, after Bill Russell leaves, Sam Jones leaves. The Celtics are in rebuild mode now.
Yeah.
But you still made the all-rookie team during that first year, so you ended up coming out pretty well.
Oh, I was just glad to be there.
Right.
There was a lot of people that we became friends, or I was glad to be in their presence and back in them the same toward me, and growing in where I grew up, as I still was right in the middle of learning how to play this game. And I couldn't have been in a better place than in Lawrence, Kansas.
No, definitely not. Now, I had read somewhere, JoJo, that you were also drafted by the Dallas Cowboys and the Cincinnati Reds.
I played all sports.
Amazing.
I played them all, yeah. I absolutely love sports, but basketball was my love. I couldn't do it. I mean, I had to convince nightly to my parents, what I was doing, until they got a chance to come and see me play, for real.
Right.
And once they did, then they understood why I loved the game. So, I was just in love with the game.
And you made the right decision. Now, the Celtics got back on track during those years. Tommy Heinsohn comes and takes the reins as head coach. The Celtics draft Dave Cowens. They trade for Paul Silas. They have the veteran Hondo Havlicek on the floor. And we have JoJo White leading the attack from the point guard position.
Yep.
Some great ball clubs during that era, JoJo.
Yeah, we did, and was respected regardless of where we played, because we put some real time, in continuous developing and finding out about not only the game itself, but how do you put it on to your highest talent that plays together out on the floor, and those gentlemen that you spoke about, they were some fantastic, athletes. And we grew together and loved one another, and we had a chance of doing some fine things, during that era.
You sure did. Now, in 72, you participated in something that I remember vividly when I was a kid, that NBA one-on-one championship that they'd hold halftime. All the kids loved that because we'd be out playing one-on-one in the streets till it got dark, like you said. Now, in 72, you went to the finals, and you had to face Bob Lanier, all 6'11 of Detroit Pistons' Bob Lanier.
We didn't care who we had to face. we knew, looking in the mirror, that at the same time, they had to face us.
You're
and
right.
They found out that what was said about them was true, as well as we had to compete, against these the tests that you had just mentioned. We had to prepare ourselves to play against them.
Right.
So we got a chance to play against, unthinkable talents, you know, but it teaches you, you know, that there are, you know, talents at that level of play.
Right.
And as long as you are playing the game, you find more and more about what makes that game tick.
We're talking to JoJo White tonight on Sports Talk 1240. So we had Havlicek, Cowens, Heinsohn, Paul Silas. Did you ever think that guys like Dave Cowens, Don Nelson, Don Chaney would be successful coaches, JoJo?
Yes. Well, it would, because it was easy playing off of what we were taught, you know, developing, you know, our game itself, because everything I know, you know, once you get on the other side, either from the coaching end, you got from the top and you pass it on to those ones who you pass it on to. So it was very, very easy, you know, to pass it on, because the ones, the kids who moved on and developed their skills found out, you know, in the right way with some of the greatest players that, I enjoyed it myself.
Sure. Definitely.
You know, Now, we
look at 1974, JoJo, the Celtics with that great team on the floor went to the NBA Finals, where they faced the Milwaukee Bucks, who were also formidable with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and the great Oscar Robertson. Now, I spoke to Dave Cowens a while back, and He didn't particularly agree, but Oscar Robertson had mentioned that the reason the Celtics won is because Lucius Allen was injured at the onset of the playoffs. Give us your opinion on what Oscar said about that.
Well, again, that's don't we all have an opinion? I mean, we're not, you know, the proof's in the pudding,
right?
You know, no matter what you say, you know, you still have to go out there and play, you know. So until you do, then you're just another player coming through.
Right.
You see, so every day, you know, we worked and trained to face the talent that we had to face before we faced it. You know, so we prepared ourselves to go through that all the way through all the levels that we played in our development process.
You sure
so
did.
I would trade it for nothing in the world.
I agree, JoJo. That was the first championship won in the post-Russell era by the Celtics. You won another one against the Phoenix Suns in the finals. You had a tremendous game with 33 points, a game-high 9 assists. You led the Celtics to a 128-126 win over the Suns and Garfield Hurd. Yep. Talk a little bit about what made that championship a little different than the one against Milwaukee.
Well, as you go, your team savvy it widens. As you learn more about the game, you find out, you know, more about who to add, who you need in order to be that level of team. You talk about playing and playing against the best in the world during that time.
Right.
So every time we played those games and those different men, that you I could see those. Young players, when I was coming up, continuing to develop my game, and every time I got a chance to play, there are players that I can name that, I'm talents on the floor, team players. I mean, their minds were on being part of a team as opposed to let me see how good or great I can be.
Very well put.
Team is spelled T-E-A-M. There's no I in the word.
That's exactly right, JoJo. Yeah, that's true.
Now, we got a chance to play at that level.
And you did.
A long time, absolutely.
And you succeeded. You went on to become one of basketball's first Iron Men. You played in 82 games for 5 consecutive seasons. What do you attribute that elasticity in that body to keep out on the floor for all 82 games for 5 seasons?
Love. Yeah. Love. You got to love what you're doing. I mean, I was in awe, you know, to be able to continue to get a chance of developing, you know, your love of the game and the game itself. And to get to play some of the players that it takes when you talk about team. Team is spelled T-E-A, and there is no I.
Right.
There is no I in the word. And so to learn and understand that, you know, means like going through it. Once you go through it and then you understand what team means, then you can train a team member. You can expect certain things out of teams based on their talent. And as you go, you find the ones who love it like you do.
Definitely.
You see, so you can take it how high? You don't know until you get out there and play it to that level.
You did.
So I played at the level you would. I couldn't wait for the next night to play.
Outstanding. Well, you did sustain an injury the following season, JoJo. You were traded by the Celtics to the Golden State Warriors in 78-79. Yeah. Had to have an impact on you. You had to feel down about that. Give us your input.
It hurts, you know, for someone to make a decision on should you move on and go somewhere else or should you stay right where you. I always felt I was where I was supposed to be. And if the Lord wanted me to be somewhere else, he'll find a way to show me. And so moving, and that wasn't a lot of places I had to move. But as you go on in life, you know, you develop, you know, development as you develop as a person. And again, your talents, you know, step up to the other ones who can play, who are waiting to be able to play with me and I with them. So I got a chance to play some of the greatest athletes and develop with and play with some of the best athletes in the world.
You sure did.
The only way you can do is spread your talents with them and go on and do your thing.
Exactly right, JoJo. Well, everything came to a fruition for you in April of 1982. Your number 10 jersey was hung from the rafters at the Boston Garden. Was that the pinnacle for you, or winning the championships? What was the top highlight for you?
Well, it's the guys that I faced. It's some of the guys that I grew up with came to some levels all at the same time. I was losing those talents as you go, and pretty soon it was like, you know, I can't pull a gun and tell those talents, please come with me and get more talent,
right.
You know, and so we can be able to continue to play. I love it so, you know, but knowing when to start, you know, it's a part of your development. It has the same line on the other end, learn when to stop.
Exactly. Now, in 1997, JoJo, you were inducted into the Kansas Sports Hall of Fame. You had your jersey retired by the Kansas Jayhawks in 2003. You were inducted into the Marine Corps Sports Hall of Fame in 2009. And you joined the 2013 class of the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame in 2013. And then in 2015, you took your rightful place in Springfield, Massachusetts, with the Immortals of the Game at the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame.
Yes, sir. I love it so much. I can't even tell you.
It certainly comes through. We certainly have gathered that tonight, JoJo. What are you doing these days, JoJo?
I'm in the front office.
Okay.
With Kansas. So we're going to try, with Lord fitting, going to try and help bring to the level that it should be, the Kansas team.
Definitely. So, well, I tell you,
I'm kind of excited, you know, getting an opportunity as we go to be back involved with the University of Kansas developing these athletes.
I can imagine you can go home again. That's one thing that you proved. Yeah. Well, JoJo, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night.
I thank you for having me on. I have a love for the University of Kansas because it seemed like when I first came here, you know, I could feel and smell that this was big for me. I remember talking to my parents, talking to them in terms of the development of what I've been blessed with, the talent to play this game. And from the time that I came to the time that I left, I loved deliciously, you know, every day and every night that I got a chance to show how good God is.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for being with us, JoJo. Hopefully we'll see you sometime up in Springfield.
Oh, you will. Thank you for having me.
You take care. JoJo White, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk to the Hall of Fame sports writer from the Boston Globe, Dan Shaughnessy, on Sports Talk 1240. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you had a good weekend. Wonderful holidays, and I hope you enjoyed the NFL games today, and I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. My next guest has been a sports writer for the Boston Globe for over 30 years, mainly covering the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Celtics. This summer in Cooperstown, he'll be awarded the 2016 J.G. Taylor Spink Award for excellence in writing baseball. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Dan Shaughnessy. Dan, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Just wonderful. I hope you're feeling a little better. I understand you're under the weather. We'll take it easy on you.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up in Groton, Mass. It may be a silly question. Who are your favorite teams, your favorite players? Who did you root for?
Well, I was all Red Sox as a kid. You know, anybody growing up in central Massachusetts, you know, those were tough years for the Sox. Yaz's rookie year was the first year I was a fan in 61. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Yankees were great then and basically kicked our butts every year. So, you know, the Sox would, you know, annually finish eighth or ninth in a 10-team league and got used to that and kind of changed in 67. But the Red Sox were always my team, and those were some tough years growing up.
Sure were. Yeah, I remember those years. Now, one of my fraternity brothers was a year behind you in high school. He recounted that you didn't do much in gym class because you were always talking with Coach Fahey and taking him away from the class.
He was John Fahey was one of my idols. He is my brother's coach. He came to Groton in 1962 and was the guy we all wanted to play for. And I was lucky enough to be on his team for 3 years. I never got to play like my brother. He wasn't great. He was the star of the team. But John Fahey was one of those role models that came to our town. And again, we had great value for him. Well, what's your friend's name?
Glenn Traquair.
Sure. Remember him. Yep.
He also noted that you loved the jumper from the corner.
That is true.
Yeah.
I couldn't do much else, but I could make the shot from the corner.
Outstanding. Now, you began your career as a beat reporter covering the Orioles for the Baltimore Evening Sun in 77. How did you get hooked up down in Baltimore?
You know, I mean, I started in Groton writing for the school paper, which wasn't much at high school, and the community paper came out once a week, and I wrote for that while I was on the teams in high school. And then at Holy Cross, I was sports editor for 3 years there. So that was a good fit. Got a chance to cover a lot of things there, and they were still relevant then. They were still D1 in football, playing Syracuse and Army and BC, and, mm-hmm. and basketball was, you know, a viable team. So I got to do some stringing for the Globe while I was there, basically stayed doing that after graduation and covered high schools for the Globe for a couple of years. And Peter Gammons is from Groton, my hometown as well, and he was a good mentor and role model. And a lot of the older Globe guys looked out for me, and I was starting out, and I was able to secure a job in Baltimore in 1977 at the age of 23 covering the Orioles, and that was the big break for me.
Not too bad. Now, you've been with the Globe for 30 years. That must have been a dream to come home and work for the Globe.
It was. You know, I mean, I grew up in my teen years and, you know, formative years reading the paper, and after 67, which we referenced, you know, it was a big deal. So to have a chance to work there as a staffer, you know, I was gone for 5 years covering the Orioles, and those were great years. And then in 81, my paper went out of business, and the Globe offered me a job to come back, and I've been there ever since.
Sure. The rest, as they say, is history. Mainly the beat writer for the Celtics and the Red Sox. What have been some of the most memorable stories you've covered through the years, Dan?
You know, I mean, we've had so many things that happened. I mean, obviously, in this century, the teams have won 9 championships, and I've been there for every one of them, all 4 sports. And the Red Sox winning, I think, in 04 at the expense of the Yankees, you know, it's still kind of the greatest sports story ever told, given all the stuff that led up to that.
Sure.
And just stuff before that. I mean, the 86 World Series with the near miss and the 78 playoff game with Bucky Dent. You know, the Celtics, 84 against the Lakers. You know, I've been to 3 Olympics. I mean, just, you know, the Patriots' first Super Bowl in New Orleans, the one they won. Just those things really stand out.
Certainly. Now, who have been some of the more memorable athletes, more memorable characters that you recall through the years? And tell us why.
Well, I mean, I got to know Ted Williams, which was a thrill.
Wow, great.
I never saw him play, but he was such an icon here and greatest hitter who ever lived and a wonderful war hero and champion of children's charities. And just he was a sweet guy at the end. He probably would have hated each other if I'd covered him when he played, but... by the time I came along, he was far removed from the game. He was very generous about today's players, and that was a thrill. You know, I got to know Bobby Orr, and, you know, he's a guy we worshipped when we were in high school, watching him play, and covering Larry Bird every day for 3 years was a big deal, and then seeing this Brady thing unfold, you know, 4 Super Bowls, he's been to 6, and probably the greatest quarterback of all time. So that's, you know, we've really got quite a cast of Mount Rushmore figures here.
Certainly. Now where did the Deflategate? I just wanted to go off for a second and ask you, how did that go over up in Boston, covering that whole story? I can imagine like a lead balloon.
Oh, people were angry. They remain angry, and it was a very emotional issue, a lot of passion. And I pretty much wasn't really a friend of the Pats on that one. I don't think they did anything grievous or horrible, but I think that they were up to something, and I think their reluctance to come clean, you know, came back to bite them with the draft pick and the fine and the initial punishment of Brady, which so far is overturned. But it was a bad time for them. It hurts their legacy, and it I don't think they win because of that stuff, but I think that people hold it against them.
Sure. Now, you wrote two books about the great rivalry with the New York Yankees, the Curse of the Bambino, which really details the travails of the Red Sox and their search for the World Series after selling Babe to the Yankees. And then you subsequently wrote Reversing the Curse after the 2004 series. Talk to us a little bit about those books, Dan.
Well, I mean, having covered the 86 Red Sox from start to finish and finishing up in Shea Stadium in Game 7, and then I launched into a book. Actually, I had been working on a book that whole year and never quite knew which way it was going to go because they were close to being eliminated in the ALCS by the Angels and very close to winning the first World Series in 68 years against the Mets and all that stuff. So, and then, after that book, it just became apparent that there was sort of a cloud over the franchise and all these near misses, and that led to the Curse of the Bambino. And then things were really ratcheting up in 03, 04 with the Red Sox-Yankee thing, and the publisher agreed we'd do something in 04. And again, I was ready on that one because I was following it every day, but a lot of people wrote books on the 04 Red Sox because it had been so long, and it's such a star power franchise with so many elite authors who were interested in the team, so it was quite a frenzy of books after that one.
Sure, yeah, what a year. Now, you're a contributor also to ESPN, the magazine, Dan. We're speaking to Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You also are involved in broadcasting, as we spoke about a little bit before the show. Talk to us a little bit about your forays into broadcasting.
Well, with guys like us, it's just extra work, and, there's local opportunities to do radio and TV, a lot of the panel shows and whatnot. And I did a number of years with Jim Rome at ESPN, Rome is Burning, which was a lot of fun. He was really good about that. And just occasional Sports Center things or whatnot, but not a whole lot. So that's just like extra stuff. It's not like Bob Ryan is really kind of more of a national broadcast guy, and he's really cornered the market on the ESPN shows and all that sort of thing. So it was just something to do to help pay the tuitions and spread the brand a little bit.
Definitely, and you succeeded at it greatly. Now, you're considered by some fans in Boston as being negative and critical overly of some of the franchises up there. Give us a little insight into how you feel about that.
Well, I think that, fans want to read good things about their teams, and I think that with the advent of the Internet, there's more availability of that now, and people sort of expect to read, it's fans writing for fans. It wasn't like that when I got in it 40 years ago, I'm still doing it the way it was done 40 years ago, which was, you come to it with subjective eyes, you cover the team, and you're a storyteller of the story, but you're not living and dying with them or betting on the team or crying if they lose. So in this era, that's kind of taken as negative. And I accept that. People, they want to read good things about their teams. In my view, that's what fan sites are for and talk radios for and team PR sites are for. Mm-hmm. But I don't expect that out of the mainstream media, and I'm just not going to be part of that.
Exactly. You're there to report the news. And that's what you do. Now, there was a character named Carl Everett that played for the Red Sox. We had him down here with the Mets. We even had him on Long Island here at the local independent ball club. Well, what was the situation with Carl Everett? I know he took exception to you and some of the things that you wrote, but people have to also consider the personality of Carl Everett.
Well, he was sort of a strange guy. I mean, he could be really charming, and he was really talented. But I think he had, issues, and those would come out on occasion, and it happened with me a couple times, and then, of course, the one everybody saw when he headbutted the umpire, Ron Culpa, and you could see his own teammates were afraid of him, and, they needed to get him out of here, and they did, and I hope he's doing okay. He seemed like a troubled guy that kind of wasted a tremendous skill set.
He could hit. Now, we're talking to Dan Shaughnessy tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You wrote a great book, I recall, with Terry Francona, who was the highly successful manager of the Red Sox. How did you enjoy working with Terry on that particular project, Dan?
I loved it. You know, I mean, it was we had to do it pretty quickly. His story was hot, and the Sox fired him in 2011 after 8 years, averaging 94 wins a year and winning two World Series. But, you know, he felt they wronged him on the way out the door. I have a good agent and had a lot of track record on writing baseball books, and, you know, I probably wasn't his favorite, which I understood, but I'm also kind of a baseball lifer, and I knew once we got away from our columnist manager roles, we'd do fine, and we did, and we kind of crashed that book in a relatively short amount of time and hit it the following spring, and the team was in a bad place when we came out, and people were anxious to read about how they got there, and the book did really well. It was New York Times number two bestseller.
Sure.
And stayed on the list a good long time. It was a hard experience, but it was really a rewarding one in every way. So Tito and I get to say we're best-selling authors.
Definitely, yeah. I remember that book, and I remember the success on the Times bestseller list. Now, 2005, the Herald accuses the Sox of leaking info to the Globe. As we know, the Globe is owned by the New York Times Company, which also has, I believe, a 17% stake in the Red Sox. The players involved, Theo Epstein, Larry Lucchino. Talk a little bit about that situation, Dan.
Well, there was a lot of stuff over the years. I mean, we had the New York Times having, as you say, the stake in the Red Sox with John Henry, but the whole thing became almost irrelevant later on. John Henry ends up buying the Globe altogether. So the situation we have now is far, far more conflicted and complicated and delicate than it was even in those years when a percentage of the paper was owned by the Times entity. Now you have the team owns the paper, and there's really nothing like it in the history of American sports that I'm aware of. I mean, I think it's unique in all of pro ball in this country.
Yeah, and for folks that don't know, John Henry also owns the Liverpool Football Club.
Yes.
Over in England. So he'll never walk alone, as they say. We're talking to Dan Shaughnessy tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Let's go to the Hall of Fame voting, Dan, if you will.
Sure.
Piazza and Griffey get in. As being a Met fan myself, I was glad to see Piazza finally get in. Did you have Piazza on your ballot?
I did not.
Okay.
No, I was a holdout on him, and I feel badly about it, and I'm glad for him. And I think Bagwell will get in next year. So less wear and tear on those of us making the decisions when they get in. So I'm happy for Mike, and I know he did great all week with his interviews, and he's really looking forward to it. And it'll be great to have a guy going as a Met. That's a great thing for everybody.
Certainly is. It's a rarity. Now, did you leave Mike off because of the PED
Yes.
situation?
Yes. I mean, again, I know it's unfair. I don't have any proof. There was enough there for me to have doubts, and I just withheld. And I wasn't alone, and that's why it took 4 years. Numerically, he's first ballot, greatest hitting catcher of all time, of course.
Should have been, yeah.
So there's no question numerically that he would be a slam dunk, and every possibility that there's nothing dirty about him either. So good luck to him. I hope that's all true.
As you say, you're not alone, Dan. I mean, I've spoken to Bill Madden about it, and Bill was a big proponent of keeping Mike out of Cooperstown, another Hall of Fame writer. So as you say, you're not the only one. Now, everybody from the Globe had Schilling on their list, so I guess the legend of the Bloody Sock lives on in New England, huh?
Yeah, I'm not exactly on board with everything with him. He and I don't like each other, and I have no use for him. But I think he's very much a bubble candidate. I don't think he's a slam dunk, but I've elected to go with him because he was 11-2 in the postseason, and he was one of the great strike machines of the 20th century. His walk strikeout ratio is just about the best in the entire century. And in a big game, I'd take him over Hunter Drysdale, a lot of guys. I just think certainly I'd take him over Messina, one game to win. So But he's no slam dunk by any means. I mean, he's up over 50% now, but I am not. It doesn't surprise me that he's not getting elected.
I think it'll be tough. I also think that maybe his political views, he's quite vociferous on social media about some of his political viewpoints, and I think that may turn a lot of writers off.
Well, I mean, it doesn't, in my view, that it should be independent of that. I mean, his political opinions are what they are, and I have no use for the guy, but I try to keep that part out of it. And again, it's difficult because he's just not a clear. You know, 216 wins is not a lot for a starting pitcher.
No, exactly. Now, upcoming, you have a guy like Vladimir Guerrero coming up on the ballot. Do you feel bad for Nomar Garciaparra?
It's unbelievable. 8 votes.
That's a very poor showing.
Ballot. And, you know, this was a guy, he was certainly on track with Jeter and you know,
A-Rod.
Right. A-Rod was clean. And, you know, he had 272 in the big leagues, 257, excuse me, 372, 357. Knocked in 98 runs in the leadoff position, and he was just an outstanding player for his 5-6 years of his career. He hurt his wrist, and he was never the same player, and his attitude became an issue. And you know, might have been a dirty guy. We don't know, but a lot of things conspired, and boy, oh boy, talk about a big fall because he was on his way.
Did you include any of the PED guys?
No.
Okay.
No.
Now, were you surprised at the rise in their numbers?
I really didn't think it was much of a rise, and I think that's that's being oversimplified. I mean, they've roomed 109 guys off the ballot, and that's a one-timer. So 109 less voters, and those are basically older guys that are more entrenched about PEDs and cheating. So I would have expected the Bonds Clemens spike to be more than the 8% spike that they got. They're both well over 120 votes away. That's a lot to make up with a voting body that's not going to change significantly in the next 4 or 5 years while they're on the ballot. So
great point.
I thought it was a setback for them rather than an advance.
Great point, Dan. Yeah. Do you feel Vlad Guerrero's a first ballot Hall of Famer?
You know, I haven't looked at it. I mean, I remember I loved watching him. I loved the way he threw and ran when he came up. You know, great bad ball hitter like Yogi. And I need to look at the numbers, but he was a really entertaining guy to watch, and I hope he comes up heads when I look at it.
How would you feel when David Ortiz comes up for election, Dan?
I'm a no on him. He failed the test in 03.
Okay.
Again, I'm not going to be inconsistent with that. So if I'm not going to vote for Bagwell and Piazza, who never failed a test, I'm certainly not going to vote for a guy who did.
Okay. Very well put. Now, your greatest thrill and memory, I guess it would be the 2004 year.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's just no getting around it. It's a biblical sports story. I mean, all the stuff that led into that, you know, 86 years for Boston, and then the 3-0 comeback against the Yanks. I mean, never been done, you know, 140 years of seven-game series. We just haven't seen it.
A huge story.
So to have that, and, you know, after all the A-Rod stuff and after the 0-3, the way the season ended with the Wakefield and Aaron Boone and just all the hard feelings of ownership, and to have it go in that fashion, World Series was very anticlimactic, of course, but that Yankee series and for the Sox to finish the deal this time, really, and like that parade was unlike any of the others. It really was a one-timer.
A great story for the city, definitely. Now, the J.G. Taylor Spink Award, you win that for 2016, had to be a tremendous honor.
I am thrilled beyond belief, and, you know, you referenced Billy Madden earlier, and I know Billy had a lot to do with getting my name nominated and getting me put up there, and it's a great honor. I love the BBWAA, I love baseball, grew up with baseball, and just looking at the names of the people who've received this award in the past, you know, Billy being one of them, and you know, Murray Chass, and going back to Red Smith and Ring Lardner and Damon Runyon, and it's very humbling, and I'm very honored.
Well, we were there last year to see Dick Enberg get the Frick and to see Tom Gage get the Spink Award, so that'll be a nice birthday present for you.
Absolutely. I appreciate that.
Now, any new projects down the pike, Dan, that you're looking at?
Not for me. Nope. Just, you know, we got a lot going on here with the football team, you know, getting ready for the playoffs. So
right.
that's a big deal right now. And then launch right to spring training. The Sox should be better next year, and looking forward to it.
That was a bad signing with Sandoval.
Well, I was in favor of it, so I can't turn on it now. I don't think it was as bad as Hanley, and I think that he is salvageable. He's never going to be worth that money. We know that, but boy, I can't believe how bad he was last year. I mean, I just expect him to do better, and I think he will do better.
Hopefully. Well, Dan, I tell you, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us, even though you're a little under the weather.
Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
We'll see you at Doubleday Field this summer.
All right, sir.
Dan Shaughnessy, folks. We'll take a little look now at the Hall of Fame election for earlier in the week. We have Griffey and Piazza, of course, going in. Jeff Bagwell with his sixth year on the ballot, garnering 71.6% of the vote. Missed it by that much, folks. He was pretty close. Tim Raines coming in on his ninth year in the ballot, 69.8% of the vote. Number five, Trevor Hoffman. First year, 67.3. Not a bad showing for Trevor Hoffman. As we spoke about with Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe, Kurt Schilling, his fourth year, 52.3% of the vote, followed by the PED men. Roger Clemens, 45.2% of the vote, and 44.3% of the vote for Barry Bonds. As Dan mentioned, with the cleaning out of the Baseball Writers Association, the older members, not a great spike in the votes for those two guys, so it may not bode well for them in the future for Hall of Fame election, and pretty rightfully so. A guy who a lot of people think should be in the Hall of Fame has the DH factor working against him. Edgar Martinez, his seventh year on the ballot, came in at number nine at 43.4% of the vote. Number 10, a guy who people think will someday be elected. I think he's a bubble candidate, too. Though Mike Mussina, his third year on the ballot, 43% of the vote. Coming in after number 10, Alan Trammell, which a lot of people are very upset about, the Detroit Tigers shortstop. In his 15th year, he'll be off the ballot now, and it'll be up to the Golden Era Committee to elect him at 40.9% of the vote. Lee Smith, the great save leader, 14th year on the ballot. He's heading to oblivion with 34.1% of the vote. The crime dog, Fred McGriff, at number 13 with 20.9% of the vote. Jeff Kent, another controversial candidate for the Hall, coming in at number 14 with only 16.6% of the vote. I wonder if some people some of these writers have seen Jeff Kent play. He certainly put up some great numbers. Larry Walker at number 15 with 15.5% of the vote. Number 16, Mark McGwire. He's off the ballot now in his 10th year, 12.3% of the vote. Doesn't look real good for Mark McGwire, a legitimate PED user. Gary Sheffield, another guy that's questionable on the PED front, number 17 at 11.6% of the vote. Coming up behind Gary is Billy Wagner, another interesting candidate. His first year on the ballot, gathering only 10.5% of the vote. A lot of people want to see Billy Wagner in the Hall of Fame. Sammy Sosa at number 19, fourth year on the ballot, only 7%. Doesn't look like Sammy's going to sniff Cooperstown. And number 20, starting with the guys that are off the ballot now for good, Jim Edmonds, who I thought would garner more support than he did at 2.5%. The rest off the ballot are, as we spoke about, Nomar Garciaparra, Mike Sweeney, David Eckstein, Jason Kendall, Garrett Anderson. How these guys garnered votes for the Hall of Fame, these writers should have their heads examined. Mark Grzelanik, Brad Ausmus, Mike Hampton, Luis Castillo, Mike Lowell, Troy Gloss, and of course, bringing up the rear, the immortal Randy Wynn. So that about does it on the Hall of Fame election, and that'll just about do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, the great JoJo White and Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe, and I'd like to thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday, January 24th, with Pro Football Hall of Fame finalist from the Washington Redskins, Joe Jacoby. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks. We'll be right back.
program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.